All right. Well, we probably should get started. So before we have all the fun, we need to do business. So I have to read this. Pay attention. See how statement of anonymity. There may be some people here, there's nobody here. There may be some people here who are not familiar with our tradition of personal anonymity at the public level. Tradition 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and other public media of communication. Thus, we respectfully ask that See How speakers and members not be photographed, videotaped, or identified by full name on audio recordings or in published or broadcast reports or meetings, including those on the internet. The assurance of anonymity is essential in our effort to help other compulsive eaters who may wish to share our recovery program with us. And our tradition of anonymity reminds us that See How principles come before personalities. A further note about anonymity. Out of respect for others, please do not take photographs during any of the events at the Global Convention. Also, be considerate when taking photographs around convention venues. Take care that you do not capture images of See How members, family members, and friends who did not give permission and may not wish to appear in your pictures. Please do not post recognizable photos of identifiable See How members on websites accessible to the public, including unrestricted pages on social networking sites. We thank you for your cooperation in observance of our tradition of anonymity. So thank you very much, everybody. Okay. No. Yeah, yes. Anybody who speaks has to sign in. So you have to sign your name, give permission to be on the audio tape. So most likely what we will do is towards the end of the session, I'll open it up for questions. So anybody who has a question can come up and sign their name and ask the question, and we'll see if we can get some answers going. So, okay. So hopefully you all know, but this particular workshop is called Step 6 and 7, A Lifetime Journey. And the reason I added that piece to it is because I've been in HOW for 25 and a half years, abstinent for 25 and a half years. Thank you. And my name is Ruth. I'm a compulsive eater, in case you don't know. Hi. And I've been maintaining 120-pound weight loss. So miracles happen in this program. I did bring pictures. A lot of people aren't doing pictures. I don't know why. I love pictures because it really does show that I belonged here, especially in the last group of years. I meet people. They don't know me as an obese person. They don't know me as somebody who struggled with food and compulsive eating and compulsive behaviors, but I am. And I belong here, and I own my seat here. And so I like to look at the pictures. I call them the oh, my God pictures, because when people look at them, they go, oh, my God. So, which today I can laugh about. Early on, not so much. But we are who we are, and I'm very grateful. And today I'm actually grateful for that person in those pictures, because she got me to be who I am today. And first thing I want to talk about is having been in the program as long as I have been and have been working a program as long as I have, one of the things that I've discovered is that the steps change, that my experience of working the steps changes as my recovery grows and as I continue in the program. So when I first got into program and I got to step 6 and 7 and I wrote the answers to the questions that we all do for these steps and I gave them to my sponsor, I'm like, thank God that's done. I don't ever have to deal with that again. And that's not really true. So, you know, it's been an ongoing process for me. One of the things that I did here, and in case you don't know what 6 and 7 are, they're looking at our character defects and then humbly asking God to remove them. And then I add a piece, which is, and then I behave as if they've been removed. Because I could sit and go, okay, well, I'm just going to keep doing it until God stops me. And just like with the food, God never stopped me from eating. God never came down and took the food out of my mouth. If I made a choice to eat, that was my choice, and he wasn't going to stop me. If I make the choice to be a bitch, if I make the choice to behave badly to somebody or treat somebody badly, he's not going to stop me from doing that. That's my choice. So I have to ask for it to be removed, which in my mind means give me the ability to not do it anymore, which is the same as with the food, right? I was never able to stop compulsively eating on my own, ever. But by surrendering to the program and turning it over to a higher power, like I said, he doesn't take the food out of my mouth, but he gives me the ability to not compulsively eat. And that's ability I never had before. So it had to come from a power greater than me. And I treat my other steps, and especially the defects, the same way. So my responsibility is to make the effort to not do or to not continue to engage in these defects that I had been doing my whole life. And having a higher power and being humble is what allows me to have the ability to do that. So one of the things that I read here in the big book, which is kind of what I want to focus my theme on for the share today, is it says, the AA way of life is the way we always should have tried to live. And that's powerful, because I was thinking about it, and compulsively eating and acting out on my character defects is not the way I wanted to live. It wasn't the person I wanted to be. Nobody grows up going, I want to be 300 pounds, and I want to be obnoxious, and I want to have no relationships with people, and I want to be alone. I mean, I didn't, but that's who I was. That's what happened. And it's not who I should have been, but I have an addiction. I have a disease that got in the way of allowing me to be who I should have been and who I should be. And by getting abstinent, I eliminated a piece of that and started to be able to be a person who doesn't have to be consumed on a regular basis with an obsession and a compulsion to eat at any cost. I mean, eating came before relationships, before family, before my job, before my health, before my hygiene, but it came before everything. I was consumed with needing to compulsively eat. And that's not who I should have been. That's not who God wanted me to be. And that, you know, so in terms of my character defects, they came out of, most of the time, they came out of fear. So I'm going to stand up a little bit, if that's okay. So just to tell you, I come from a dysfunctional, alcoholic, crazy family. And one of the results of that is that I lived in constant fear. And it says in our literature that our character defects are driven by fear. So what that means to me is that all the things that I did, all the acting out I did, all the bad behaviors that I did, all were motivated by whatever fear I was living with. And fear is a terrible thing when I don't know what to do with it. Years ago, I did a workshop, and they said, could you do the topic of fear? And I said, fear, okay, well, do you want me pro or con? And I decided to do pro. Because fear is the only motivator I have to change, right? Fear and pain, that's it. If I'm comfortable, I'm not going to change. I'm not going to make the effort to change. So I'm grateful that I had the fear, but until I knew what to do with it, the fear drove me. It drove me to behave badly. It drove me to live in my character defects. And one of the things that I learned early on, because I didn't understand really, and I don't know, maybe all of you are smarter than me, I didn't really understand what a character defect was. So I thought, well, if I get rid of all my character defects, who am I going to be? I'm not going to be anybody. Because character defects are who I am. But you know what? They're not. They're not who I am. They're things that I do. They're behaviors that I've developed, usually to protect myself or to survive. I'm a survivor. I'm a cancer survivor, I'm an addiction survivor, I'm a family dysfunction survivor. I have survived so many things in my life, and as a result of that, I get to be the person I should be. So when I was thinking about, well, what are character defects? I don't even know what those are. And one of the things that I heard early on was that it's character traits taken to an extreme. And by an extreme, what I mean is they're not working in a way that makes my life work today. And when I first came in, they were glaring. I mean, it talks about the seven deadly sins in the book. It talks about all types of behaviors, you know, stealing and lying and cheating and all those things, which I did all those things, usually around food. I would steal food. I would lie about a food. I would steal money to buy food. I would eat other people's food. I would eat food out of the trash. I would, you know, it didn't matter. So I did all those things. And so those, when I got here, those were very, very large, glaring behaviors that were making my life miserable. It just, they were not working for me. But I didn't know what to do about it till I got here. And then you guys tell me what to do. You could write about it. You could pray about it. You can look at it. You can talk about it. And I add, stop doing it, which is important. People sort of leave that part out. But that's a very important part. Because for me, I could talk about it from here until I'm 107 years old. But if I'm still doing it, it doesn't do anything, right? So I can talk about it to help identify it, but then I actually have to do it different. I have to change. So, like I said at the beginning, my experience with these steps changes over time. So when I first got here and I started doing the work, I wrote the answers to the questions, and that I figured was doing the steps. That was a beginning. It wasn't really doing the steps. It was writing questions. But I learned some things. I learned some things about behaviors that I was doing that I didn't know were causing me difficulties, or I didn't know where they were coming from. I'll give you an example. I think one of the questions that it asks is about, can you list any traits that seem to be good traits but are really covering up bad traits or defects? And first of all, I'm only abstinent like 6 months. You can't like talk to me like that yet, because I'm very foggy, right? So I met with my sponsor. I'm like, I don't know what they're talking about. Masquerading? I don't know what that is. But we talked about it, and one of the things that came up for me was that I always felt that I had a very good sense of humor. I could always be very funny, and I could always make people laugh. It's one of, you know, I could be the clown kind of thing, you know, the jolly fat person that makes jokes before other people will. So I always thought that I had a good sense of humor, which to me was a good trait. However, when I looked at it, what I realized was that underneath that, I was angry, and I was resentful, and I was using my humor to hurt people. So I would be biting, or I would be you know, underhanded in my my comments or my jokes about somebody or something, and it was hurtful to people. I think. I mean, I don't know. I hadn't really asked anybody, but looking at it myself, I knew where it was coming from. So that's where the writing really helped. The writing and the talking about, because I could identify it. Okay. So now I knew. But that didn't mean I actually stopped doing it yet. Right. I had to actually stop doing it. So what I've found is that the awareness comes first. So then I know that it's happening. Then I continue to do it, and I watch it happening while I'm doing it. And I see that it's happening, but I'm still doing it. And then eventually, I catch it before I do it. Like, I want to do it. Like, I really want to do it. But I'm going to catch myself, and I'm going to pause, and I'm not going to do it until eventually I have no desire to do it. And that's where I want to get to. Because I don't want to white knuckle. I don't want to white knuckle the food. I don't want to white knuckle my behavior. I don't want to need to say that really horrible thing, but I'm going to white knuckle not saying it. Because I'm going to have to go out and eat over that. Because I may not say that thing to you, but it's in here, and I'm going to go out and eat. So eventually, what I want to get to is where I don't have to compulsively eat, and I don't have to behave in those ways, and I don't have to do those things to make me feel bad. You know, I feel bad when I do those things. You know, the character defects, the ones that trouble me the most, are the ones that after I behave in a certain way, I feel shame, or I feel bad, or I feel embarrassed. That's a big one for me. Because I'll behave in a certain way, and then I'll have so much shame and embarrassment that I can't tolerate the feeling. And then I have to eat over it. I remember one time, oh my God, I behaved so badly. Even today when I think about it, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. But I was dating this guy, this was like in my late teens, and I called him like all day, and he never called me back. And I'm calling, and he never called me back. And I'm like, I'm freaking out. I can't tolerate it. You know, I have abandonment issues. You have to call me back. I don't know where he is. He's with another girl. I don't know what the heck. So I go over to his house. And I'm standing on the front lawn of his house in a neighborhood, screaming at the top of my lungs. This is not normal behavior. Okay? This is not what normal people do when they have a feeling. But I'm screaming at the top of my lungs until finally he comes out. He was in there the whole time. He comes out and it's like, what are you doing? I mean, it was like I was insane. When we talk about in step two, restore me to sanity, and people say, how rude, I'm not insane. I was insane. That was insane behavior. But I couldn't help it. I couldn't not do it. Because I had such fear and such low self-esteem and such demons working inside of me that I didn't have an option. I didn't know what else to do. And one of the things that I love about recovery is it gives me options. Because that feeling can come up again. But I don't have to run to somebody's house and stand on the front lawn and scream at the top of my lungs. I can pray about it, I can write about it, I can do other things and I can deal with it until eventually those feelings don't overwhelm me. And one of the things about 6 and 7 is that my defects overwhelmed me. They overwhelmed me. I couldn't control them, I couldn't understand them, I couldn't deal with them, I couldn't face them, they overwhelmed me. And so one of the things about recovery is to not get overwhelmed by these things. You know, coming from where I came from, everything overwhelmed me. I broke a fingernail one day. You thought that somebody had died. And I'm being serious. I know this is kind of ha-ha funny. But the truth is, I ran from nail salon to trying to find someone to fix my fingernail because I broke my fingernail. However, I had cancer. I didn't even tell my sponsor for a year that I had had cancer. Because cancer, who cares? I could have died. That's not a big deal. But my fingernail, now that was a big deal. I was really, you know, that. Do you know what I mean? This is crazy. So these character defects that are driven by this insanity inside of me, these demons, these fears, these absolute consuming, overwhelming thoughts, like thoughts that I'm going to die if I don't do this, or I have to do this or you'll leave me, or whatever it is, these are the thoughts that make me behave in ways that aren't how I should be. They're just not how I want to be. And even when I was doing them, it wasn't what I wanted to do. I didn't want to be standing on the front lawn screaming like an idiot, but I didn't have a choice. There was nothing else I could do. I was so consumed with feelings. They were so overwhelming, and I didn't know what to do with them. So this was, you know, so early on in my recovery, I did the writing of the steps, and I talked about it, and I would go to step study meetings, and I would read the steps over and over, and I would slowly start to understand a little more, and I was able to stop acting out in these real extreme ways that I was acting out before. I'm happy to say I never screamed on the lawn in front of somebody's house after that, so I'm happy that's progress, right? We get to have progress. So a lot of the big glaring defects started to leave. I didn't need to do them anymore. But what happened is that as time went on and I stayed in recovery, because what I've seen happen over the years is a lot of times when the glaring issues are resolved, whether it's, you know, being overweight and you lose all your weight, or you know, you deal with some of the bigger problems in your life, you deal with your job or you deal with your spouse or something, and things get resolved and you feel better and life seems to be doing better, I see, okay, I'm done, and out you go. And it's like, okay, now I'm done, life is good, and off I go. And I'm so grateful that I never thought that. I don't, you know, at the time I'm like, why is everyone else done? And I'm not done. But I knew I was not done. Because even though my life was working better, I definitely knew that there was more to do. And that's kind of what I want to share more about is the journey part of steps 6 and 7, and really the journey of all the steps, because they're the things we work forever, God willing, one day at a time. But 6 and 7 is something that I do all the time. Not necessarily consciously. Like I said at the beginning, I would write it out, or if something happened, I would write down my feelings, or I would, you know, write out my amends or whatever was going on. But now what's starting to happen over the last maybe 10 or 15 years of my recovery is that it says it in the book, it becomes automatic. Right? At the beginning, it says this is a lot of work. This takes a lot of time and energy to figure out what's going on with me, figure out what the demon is, figure out how to do it, you know, do it different, figure out what my options are. I mean, it's exhausting. It takes a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of work. And to be honest, a lot of willingness and a lot of commitment. You know, as you could probably see, we don't have a lot of step sponsors in our program. Well, why is that? Because this is hard work. This is really hard work to do this. I thought stopping eating was hard work. That was like the easiest that was the easiest part, right? So looking at this stuff and doing this work was hard. But what I'm here to tell you today, because I do have the 25 and a half years of working this program, and what I want to tell you is it gets easier. It does. It gets easier. And what starts to happen is it becomes automatic, in the sense that automatically you know how you want to be and what you want to do and how you want to deal with this. And when you say intuitively know how to handle situations, they're talking about 6 and 7, because when I didn't know how to handle situations, I handled them badly, like really badly, like total opposite of how a sane person would handle them. But as time goes on, and as I'm working, and as I'm working a program and developing my spiritual process and working with others and sponsoring people and doing all the things the program says, all these things that seemed so hard at the time get easier. And so I want to encourage everybody to stick it out, because there are hard times. There are times where you feel like, I'm just never going to get it, or I'm never going to do it. There were so many years where I'm like, oh my God, I'm just never going to get it. Not the food stuff, but just one of my big issues was interpersonal relationships with other people. I'm not good at them. I never was good at them. I don't have social skills. Like I said, I come from dysfunction, so we didn't have social skills. I wasn't taught how to interact with other people. And to be honest, I didn't really like other people. I was afraid of them. Everybody hurt me. I was a kid that was beat up a lot in school, so I just assumed everybody was going to hurt me. So I was an isolator. I spent most of my time by myself. And so one of my big things, probably 8 or 10 years into recovery, where my life was going good, I was maintaining my weight, I wasn't fighting with compulsive eating, I was, you know, a lot of my glaring defects were gone, but some things still weren't working in my life. There were things that I wanted to do and things that I wanted to be that I wasn't. And I knew that I had to keep working. And so, you know, I dug a little deeper. You know, I went into some other programs and I started to look at some other things that motivated my fears, motivated my inability. You know, it says in the literature, I love the literature, it says that as addicts and coming up in a life of addiction, that I have an inability to interact intimately with other human beings. It didn't say, oh, you have problems with people. It says, I have an inability to interact with other people in an intimate way. And that was absolutely true for me. It was. So yeah, I had, you know, I had a fellowship and I had a job and I had, you know, I had what looked like from the outside a very nice life. But there were still demons happening. There were still defects that were happening, like I was withdrawing from people, or I wouldn't reach out to people, or I would behave badly because I was afraid, and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to push you away before you push me away, or I'm going to judge you before you judge me. That was a big one. You know, I'm judgmental. I'm not judgmental because I'm a terrible person. I'm judgmental because if I can judge you first, then I don't have to be afraid of you judging me, because I've already judged you and I've already discounted you, so what you think of me, I've already discounted it. So I get to, so what happens? If I'm judging someone, I'm like, okay, what am I afraid of? What am I afraid of? And I start to see, oh, they may not like me. or they may be thinking something about me. You know, so those things start to come up, and I get to be able, but it happens fairly quickly. I don't have to spend a year writing about it like I did at the beginning. You know, at the beginning, I would write about the same thing over and over and over for like weeks and weeks and weeks, and it can be frustrating at times, right? It's like, get over it already, but you know, it comes when it comes. But over time, and I stuck it out, and eventually, over time, it happens really quickly. Like in a couple of minutes, I've identified it, I've done it, I've seen it, and then I don't have to do it anymore. One of the things I love about it is when I shift, I shift. Okay? So it may take a lot of time and a lot of work to get to that shift, but once I've shifted, I've shifted. And I always think about it in terms of, I heard an interview on TV with an actress who had done like this big movie, and she became this big famous actress, and the person said, you know, how does it feel to be an overnight success? And she said, I've been working for this overnight success for 10 years. And I related that to my recovery. It's like I work and I work and I work, but in a minute, I shift and it feels like it's overnight. Like I just went from this person to this person. But the truth is that I did a lot of work to get to be in a place where in a second I can shift. And then all of a sudden, I don't have to be that person anymore. I don't need to do that anymore. One of the examples that I like to give is that my mother was very controlling. And one of the ways that she would control us is by being late for everything. And then we would all have to sit and wait for her. So we were late to my sister's graduation, we were late, you know, whatever it is. And we, being wonderful dysfunctional family, would sit and wait. Like normal people would say, well, we're going without you. Well, that never even occurred to any of us. You know, I mean, I'm the kid, but even my father, you know, it's like nobody, it never occurred to anybody, well, you're not ready, we're leaving. No, we would all sit and wait and stew and be mad and have a good resentment and all of that. And but that's how she controlled us. And I felt very controlled by her making me wait. So I have this friend years ago, and we would make plans to get together for lunch. And every time we get together for lunch, she'd be 20 minutes late. Every time. And I would sit there and I would stew and I'd build a great resentment and I'd be mad. And then the next time I'd meet her for lunch, 20 minutes late, and I'd get to do it all over again. And I was doing this over and over and over. And one of the things about defects is, how do I know it's a defect? It's bothering me. It's causing my life to be unmanageable. It's creating havoc in my life and in myself. So that's a good identifier, right? That's a good flag. And as we say in Al-Anon, you know, it's like a red flag. Don't say it's purple. It's red. So let's look at it. It's a red flag. So I had to look at it, and I had to write about it. And what I did was, and one of the tools that really helps me is to do a backwards inventory, which means I start today, and I write things in my history working backwards that are I felt the same or when the same thing happened over and over until I get to the core thing at the beginning. And the core thing is always, you know, my childhood, my family. So I got to that my mother would control me by being late and making me wait. So I was reacting to my friend as if she was my mother. I didn't know that. She doesn't look like my mother. She wasn't my mother, but in here, in the deep gut of my being, she was my mother. Oh my God. So when I discovered that, I did an experiment, right? And I said, I'm gonna have lunch with my friend and I'm gonna see what happens. So I went and we had lunch and she was 20 minutes late. And those whole 20 minutes, I'm going, she's not my mother. She's not my mother. They must have thought I was out of my mind. She's not my mother. She's not my mother. Really, she's not my mother. Maybe she has an unmanageable life. Maybe she's always running late. Maybe it has nothing to do with me. But she's not my mother. And I did that for 20 minutes until she showed up, and then we had our lunch and it was fine. Here's the test. Once I've shifted, I've shifted. So I had to do an experiment. So I made arrangements for lunch again, and knowing she's going to be 20 minutes late, and I say, okay, I'm going to go and I'm going to see, Am I really cured? Am I like, have I healed that? Or am I gonna go back to being resentful? So I go and I'm sitting there, nothing. Nothing. I tried to get a resentment. I'm like, how dare she? Oh well, who cares? I'm like, what? You know, it's like I tried to get that feeling up and I couldn't get it to come up. And that was like the first time that I realized why I do this work. Because when I shift, when I change, I'm changed. When it talks about the spiritual experience in the back of the book, a psychic shift in attitude and perception, my experience is when that happens, I'm changed. And I don't go back. Now, I may have other things to work on as time goes on, but I don't go back to that same one. And that's why I do the work. That's why I look at my character defects. That's why I practice behaving as if they've been removed, because eventually they will be removed. And eventually I will have shifted and I will not go back to being that person. Do you know what I mean? It's awesome. It's like, it's not anything I came here for, and I didn't even understand it when I was doing it. One of the reasons why I like to share about it is so that maybe someday, because this happened to me, where people would share stuff when I was new. I'm like, what are they talking about? I have no idea. I'm on step one, okay? I don't know what you're talking about. But 5 years later, I'm going through something. I'm like, oh, that's what they were talking about. Now I get it. So I'm saying this so you can remember, maybe a year from now, 5 years from now, tomorrow, whenever, that I'm telling you that if you continue to behave as if they've been removed and you continue to do the work, one day you will have changed. And one day we will be different. I am different. And not only am I different today than I was when I first got here, I'm different every day. Every day I'm different than the day before. Some little, some big. You know, I've had a few, you know, spiritual experiences of the lightning bolt kind where all of a sudden I just know something happened, something like just wow happened. And then I've had a lot educational variety kind where I'm just, like I said, I'm just doing the work. I'm doing the work. I'm trying. I'm doing it different. I'm paying attention. I'm doing. And then one day I'm different. One day I'm different. So this is why I'm still here. I've been maintaining my weight for almost 23 years. That's a long time. Why am I still here if it's just about the weight? So it's not. It's really about, I want to be the person I should be. I want to live the life that I should live. And I don't know any other way to do that for me as a recovering addict than to work these steps. And especially 6 and 7, because 6 and 7 are the things that make me live the way I don't want to live. And they make me be the person I don't want to be. So if I want to be different, I got to do different. And how do I do different? I work these 2 steps, and I humbly ask God to help me to be different, to help me to do things differently, and to have a different perspective and have a different attitude. I mean, 99% of everything is attitude. And I had a bad attitude. When I got here, I had a bad attitude. I had given up. I was hopeless. I had hated everybody. I decided, you know, I don't know about you, but every time I dieted, I hated everyone because they could eat and I couldn't. Right? So I was always mad. I lost weight many times, but I was never happy, joyous, and free, ever. And it talks about that in the book. You know, when you read some of the stories of the old-time alcoholics who are like, not drinking is not fun, you know? And it's like, not eating is not fun when I'm trying to do it myself, when I can't replace it with something. One of the things that I said early on is, if you're going to take my food away, you better replace it with something, because it's all I got. It's all I got. And if you take it away, and that's what all the diets were, took all my food away, but I didn't have anything else. So what was I going to do? I had to go back to the food. It's the same with defects. If you're going to take away this behavior, you better replace it with something. You better teach me how to be kind and loving and gentle, because I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to be compassionate. I mean, when I first got to program, and I know none of you are going to believe this, I was called the Ice Princess. I wasn't the nicest person that you've ever met. And it was out of fear. And it was out of fear of, you know, I mean, no, I had never been hugged. Again, I come from a dysfunctional family. We never touched each other. We never hugged. I never saw my parents hug. All of a sudden, I'm in a room and people are trying to hug me, you know. And it was very scary and very vulnerable. And I'm like, I can't. But I can. Because I had to. One of the things that I love in the program is where Bill says that you come here and you do this because you have to. And I came here and I did this because I had to. I was dying. I had heart palpitations. I was in line for a stroke. I had high blood pressure. I had high cholesterol. I was on medications. I was almost 300 pounds. I was walking with a cane. I wore two muumuus that I rotated from day to day. This was my life. And I was 30 years old. And I was just waiting to die. Okay? So I came here because I had to, or I was going to die. But then he says, but you have to at some point be here because you want to be here and you want the benefits. And so somewhere along the line, because here's what happens. You get in, I'm desperate, I get in, I'm willing to look at my defects, I'm willing to try to be different, I'm willing to do things I've never done before, and then I start to feel better. And then I'm not desperate anymore. Well, now that I'm not desperate, I'm not really willing as willing as I was when I got here and I was desperate. And people always say to me, how do you have that much time? And I say, well, I work it as if I'm desperate without being desperate. Now, I don't know how to tell you to do that, but this is all I know, because I'm not any different from anybody else. I could eat in a minute. There's nothing stopping me from eating. So I could eat in a minute. Why I don't is because I am as desperate today as I was when I first got here. I'm just not living desperate, which means that I know that I will die if I compulsively eat. And I know that if I don't work on my character defects, I will compulsively eat, and then I will die. And I know if I don't get a conscious contact with a higher power, I won't be able to work on my defects, and then I will have to eat, and then I will die. It all comes back to that. So I have to do everything I have to do. So when Bill says, at some point, you have to do this because you want the benefits, this is what I do this for. And to me, the benefits are to live the life I should live. And I don't necessarily know what that is. God is in charge, so I don't know. I mean, I did not plan to be living in Las Vegas, I'll tell you very much. Okay? I mean, I spent a year, I met my husband on vacation, he lived here, and I went back to LA, and for a year I said, I'm not moving to Las Vegas. I'm not moving to Las Vegas. Are you listening? I am not moving to Las Vegas, and I have people who will testify that I said that for a year. And then I'm like, why am I not moving to Las Vegas? I just woke up one day and I'm like, why am I not moving? And off I went to Las Vegas. That wasn't my plan. I planned to not move to Las Vegas. But I kept showing up and I kept doing what I was supposed to do. And I kept working a program and something shifted. And all of a sudden, what I was absolutely sure I am not able to do, I'm able to do. And things that I'm absolutely sure are never going to happen, happen. It's unbelievable. And all I have to do is show up and work a program. I don't have to decide what it's supposed to be. I don't have to make it happen. All I have to do is show up and be willing to live the life I should live. And God knows what that is. God had a plan for me. But I said, sorry, God, I have my own plan. My plan is to eat myself to death, stay in my apartment until I die. I heard somebody say that he just want, you know, an alcoholic said, I was just going to kill myself. And my plan was to go to bed and wait till I die. And that I really related to. Because I wasn't going to go and buy a gun and kill myself, but I was just going to keep eating until I die. That was my plan. But God had a different plan. And I'm so grateful for that. And all I have to do is show up for it. I don't have to know what it is. I always say that I'm in the CIA. I'm on a need-to-know basis. And if I don't need to know, I don't know. And I'm not going to know until I need to know. And when I need to know, I will know. So I didn't know I was moving to Las Vegas until the day I said, why am I not moving to Las Vegas? And then I was moving to Las Vegas. This is how life happens. Now, I'm a control freak, so I want to know 10 years in advance where I'm going to be 10 years from now. I don't get to do that. Because what that did was got me to 30 years old, 300 pounds, in my apartment, by myself, binging my brains out, wishing I was dead. That's where my plans got me. So the defects, the humbly part, humbly ask God, because that was the other thing, was this whole humility thing, because I do not like to be humiliated. And as a fat person, you can imagine that I was humiliated a lot. I'm the person that doesn't want to be noticed as I'm walking across the room and then I fall in the middle of the room. I have done that many times. Or I'll be walking across the street at a green light, cars are stopped, and I fall on my face in the middle of the street. These are the things that I do because I'm so terrified of being humiliated. So I lived in humiliation. And if other people weren't feeling humiliation for me, I was feeling it for myself. So when they said humbly, I'm like, no, I don't want that. But what I understood was the humbly is moving out of the way. Moving out of the way and letting God do his work. Now, I didn't really know how to do that, so I just followed what people told me to do. You know, it's like one day at a time. Don't worry about tomorrow. I'm like, what do you mean don't worry about tomorrow? If I don't worry about tomorrow, who will worry about tomorrow? What will happen tomorrow if I don't worry about tomorrow? But they said, don't worry about tomorrow. And practicing, eventually, I didn't worry about tomorrow. And today I could say, I don't worry about tomorrow. And it doesn't mean I don't plan for my life. It doesn't mean that I don't know I'm going to go to work on Monday. It doesn't mean that. What it means is I'm not invested in what's happening tomorrow. I'm here right now. See, I'd much prefer to be invested in what's happening tomorrow, so I don't have to be here right now. Because right now, when I was in the disease, right now, not a good place. Didn't like it, didn't enjoy it, was not having a good time. So I always wanted to be way in the future or way in the past. So the way in the past was, oh, if only this had happened, then I'd be happy. If only my parents had done this, I wouldn't be fat. If only. And one of the things I heard is recovery starts when I stop wishing my past was different. Except the past is what it was. I heal from the wounds of that, and I get to move on, and I get to have the life I should have. And today, I can tell you, quarter of a century, kills me, quarter of a century later, I have the life I should have today. And it doesn't mean that my life is perfect, or it doesn't mean that I have everything I thought I should have. What it means is that today, I know I'm living the life I should have. And I know I'm being the person that I should be. There's a peace about it. There's a calm about it when I'm not trying to be different or trying to have different or trying to be somewhere different. There's a calm that this is exactly where I'm supposed to be, doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing. Now, tomorrow I may be doing something else, and that'll be what I should be doing. So that it's an amazing thing. Now, I didn't have this feeling when I had a year or 5 years or even 10 years, to tell you the truth, right? So I really want to encourage this idea because we don't have a lot of experience with long, long, long-term recovery in this program. So I want to be able to share with you that these are the things that happen if you keep working a program. And I'm so grateful that I stuck around. You know, we say don't leave till the miracle happens. I say don't leave till the next miracle happens because a miracle happens every day. Every day. And if I leave today, I miss the miracle tomorrow. And I've missed too many miracles already. I spent 30 years of my life drowning, unconscious, miserable, unhappy, alone. I don't want to spend one more day like that if I don't have to. Not one. And I've been through a lot of things abstinent. I've moved, I've gotten married, I lost both my parents. I've had good things, bad things, all sorts. I've had life happen in the last 25 years. And one, I was able to stay abstinent. But more importantly than that, I mean, obviously abstinence is very important, but in addition to it, because to be honest, abstinence is not enough for me. Just being abstinent is not enough for me. I want more. Well, I'm an addict, so I always want more. But I want more. And what the program offers me is way more than just being abstinent. It offers me the ability to look at my life, look at myself, and decide, who do I want to be? What do I want to do? Do I want to continue to behave like that? Do I want to continue to have those kinds of relationships? Here's one, another thing. So I found that I kept attracting a certain type of person, a person that was very needy and would, you know, thank you, and, you know, very self-centered and, you know, because I'm a giver. Because if you need me, then I have value, right? That's where I got my value. I didn't have value on my own, but if you needed me, then that gave me value. So I was attracting all these very needy people who would suck me dry and never give anything back. And eventually I figured that out. It took a while. You know, I just kept going from person to person because eventually they leave because they've sucked you dry and then they move to the next person. So then I would have to find a new person. And there's no shortage of new people. But so eventually I'm looking at it because, again, doing an inventory backwards and going, okay, this is happening a lot. This is like happening a lot. So I look at it and I go, oh, okay. Well, I just need to find different kinds of people. And that wasn't really working very well. And I'm like, huh, okay, why is that not working? And what I got to was, it wasn't them, it was me. And that when I changed, I attracted different people. When I didn't need you to need me for me to have value, then you had no interest in me. Because all of a sudden, I didn't need you. I could and I don't mean it in a bad way. I mean, like, I didn't need you to define who I was. I was my own person. So someone who, you know, wanted to suck someone dry is going to move. I call it the beware of dog syndrome. Because if you have a beware of dog sign on your house, the burglar goes to the next house. So I had a thing say, beware, I don't need you. I don't need you to need me. And then they would move on to the next person. So what I found is by working on my character defects, things happened I never even imagined. Like, I started to change, which then changed all my relationships. And a lot of them went by the wayside because when I was a certain way, they worked, and then they didn't when I changed. And that happens sometimes. But it opened it up for new relationships. And today I can say that I have healthy relationships. I don't have relationships with anyone who abuses me. I don't have relationships with anybody who treats me without respect. I don't have any relationships where people abandon me in a way that's, I mean, people leave, clearly, but not in a hurtful way. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't allow those kinds of things anymore. And not because I'm saying, I'm not going to allow that and I'm going to have boundaries. It's because I don't need it. I don't need it. I don't need it. I am my own person. I have my own value. I don't need to earn self-esteem. I have self-esteem. I deserve to be on this planet. These are things I did not know. These are things I did not know when I got here. But today I have those. And as a result of that, that energy attracts a different kind of person. And so I get to have really... Now, if I had met my husband, we've been together 13 years. If I had met my husband 20 years ago, he would not be my husband. One, because I wouldn't have even paid attention. But two, he wouldn't have been attracted to me. Because I was not the person then that I was when he met me. Do you know what I'm saying? This is why this work is so important. It's not so important because, oh, I don't want to be obnoxious or, you know, I want to have friends or whatever. This is so that I can be different. This is the point. Abstinence is so I can be different. Working the steps, and especially 6 and 7, is because I wanted to be different. I didn't want to be that same person. I didn't want to keep doing those things over and over. The insanity of doing it over and over and expecting that it's going to be different. And for me, the insanity was doing it over and over, knowing it was going to be exactly the same and doing it anyway. Because I had no choice. I didn't know what else to do. So I really wanted today to say that I wanted to encourage that this is a process, and it's a lifetime process, God willing. For me, I pray every day that I live out the rest of my life in See How and abstinent and working these steps every day. And I want to encourage everybody else to do that too by saying that it gets easier and that it becomes something that it gets integrated. It's been integrated as part of who I am. It's so funny because one of the big things that I had to learn was to pause, because I had a little vomit thing going where I would think it and it would come, you know, and I would just say stuff and, you know, and then be sorry after. And so eventually I had to say, you know what, how about if you think about it first, maybe pause and think about what you want to say before you say it. So I had to practice. And the funny thing was that as I was practicing, people were noticing and they would say, like, uh-oh, she's not saying anything. Like, they would get nervous. I'm like, I'm thinking, you know, because it would be like this silence, because I had to think about, what do I want to say? Why would I want to say that? You know, what am I trying to do? What, you know, what's going on? And I would pause. Now, it's been so integrated that the pause takes like this much time, like a half a second. And I'm able to process and identify why I want to say what I want to say, or is this the right appropriate thing to say, or, you know, what's going on, and then I get to say it or not say it, or say it differently, or say it quieter, or whatever it is, but I get that option. Before, I didn't have that option. I thought it, out it came. I thought it, in it went. That was it. No pause, no nothing. And the same thing with food. I think about it, I'm going to pause, and maybe in 20 minutes the feeling will go away. I never knew that because I always ate. I never knew the feeling goes away. Well, it does with the defects, too. I mean, there were times where I was like, I have to call right now. And I'm like, okay, if I wait 5 minutes, maybe I won't have to call. And then I wouldn't have to call. And then I wouldn't have to make an amends. And then I wouldn't have to feel bad. And I wouldn't have to do all that stuff. So it's really, really important to understand that these steps are not just here to give us work or to make us busy or to have our sponsors be able to say, oh, go right on it. You know, they're really here to give us an opportunity to change and to be different. And I'm so grateful that today I am not the person I was at all. And it's not because of me. It's because of the tools and the ability to do things differently when I didn't have that ability before. I didn't even know about it. So I'm very high on these steps still, which is so awesome. And I'll just, you know, kind of close with saying a funny thing. So I was, when I started, I went to a meeting every single day. And for all the years that I lived in Los Angeles, which is about 12 and a half years of my recovery, I went to meetings every day, sometimes two, three times. They used to have recovery places. I would sit all day, every meeting, SA, LA, whatever, FA, didn't matter, AAA, whatever it was, I would just sit all day long in meetings. And then when I moved here, we didn't have as many meetings, so I go to 5 meetings a week. So if you do the math, of 25 and a half years of a meeting, at least a meeting every day, listening to the readings that we read at the meetings every day, you can imagine how many times I've heard the readings, the steps and the tools and the concept and all of those readings. So I was in about 5 years, and a guy was sitting next to me, and he had been in for about 2 weeks, and they were reading the steps or something, and he turned to me and he says, if I have to hear these goddamn readings one more time, I'm going to scream. And I'm thinking, you know, and at that moment, I was so grateful because I never felt like that. Even today, in a meeting, I'm listening to what it's saying. I'm listening. Those are my lifesavers. Those are my, sorry. Those are the things that save my life. Not that kind. But those are the things that I hold on to for dear life. And so I love to hear them all the time. And so I encourage you to have a positive, exciting attitude about recovery. You know, I've heard people say, I hate being in How. I don't want anybody to know I'm in How. It's embarrassing. I hate How. I love being in How. It is an honor to be in How. It's a gift. It's a miracle. How many people are out there that need this program and don't have it? It's a miracle to be here. And I love to have that attitude that I appreciate being a part of the program. I do service. I participate. I love it. I love it. And I'm so grateful to be here. And so I'm going to close with that. And then we have about 15, 20 minutes if we want to open it up. Maybe if some people have some questions for me or anything. Oh, thank you. Thank you. I have to do that. Page was 357.
I'm Alexia. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Alexia.
Thank you, Ruth. I'm so grateful to be here. Sue, thank you for telling me about this workshop. Just what I needed. I raised my hand. I didn't pause to formulate the question because what I'm going to refer to is I understood your whole process and I loved it so much when you talked about the person who was always late. That you just, when you were able to identify it, then it didn't have any meaning. And I have experienced that in my life, too, with things that it's just like, that's how it is. I'm not taking it personally. For example, if I go into a supermarket and the line's long, I can sit there and it just doesn't have any weight. I can be patient. But what came to mind when you were telling that story is I thought what you were going to say is... that you either A, would have left like in that 20-minute time, or you would have come later, like knowing that she's always that late, and so I was really surprised with the way that story went, that's just an observation. It's not really even a question. I'm just processing that. Like, how did you know to sit with that and not have it been like setting a boundary or...
Okay. Well, I guess I didn't really finish the whole story because I kind of hit the point I hit. So the two things I want to say. One, I guess what I didn't elaborate on is that once I did the inventory going back, the key was healing that wound of my mother's control. So it wasn't just... getting back to that and identifying, oh, I was thinking it was my mother, but I'm wounded. And all those wounds that happened from my childhood have to be healed. So I think of it like a cut on my hand. So when the cut is open, everything hurts. If you touch it, you drop something on it, you put lemon juice, oh my God, it hurts so bad. But once it's healed, the wound is still there and there's a scar, but you could touch it, you could hit it, it doesn't matter, it doesn't hurt anymore. So that was the one piece I left out about that process, right? So it's where the wound got healed through that process. But the other is that the end of the story is, I want to be free. This is the whole point of doing what I do. I want to be free. So if I had to not go to lunch with her because it made me crazy, that's not free. If I had to show up late because she's always late, that's not free. So I had to find how I got to be free. And the way I did was that I showed up the way I show up. It didn't bother me. She showed up. We had lunch. But I will say that as I moved forward, I got to decide, is this somebody I want to have a friendship with who can't show up in a way that is respectful? And eventually, we stopped having lunch as often because that was my choice. But I was free. It wasn't out of needing to set a boundary. It wasn't out of fear. It wasn't out of being uncomfortable. So I needed to work through all those things first and show up even though she was going to be late and I knew it, and be okay, so that I could then be free to make whatever choice I wanted. I don't want to choose to do something out of fear or out of being uncomfortable. Does that make sense?
Yes, so that was sort of the end of the story. Thank you so much. So my takeaway from that is, and just so I can bring it into my life, is just really having that pause of I want to be free.
That's a good one.
Yeah. I want to be free. Thank you.
You're
that
welcome.
That helped so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Reese. So we obviously work together, and I am asking you something all the time of how I am in the process, in the middle of making a change. So I'm going to allow this to be open because you know me, but what's happening is that I am not doing it well. And is that because I don't really want to change that the pendulum is swinging so much? Is it that I'm not doing it so gracefully that it is such a struggle to want to be different? Because I am aware I do want it to be different. I do want to be free. And you just say it's a pendulum swinging, eventually I'll sit. So I'm not getting enough from that pendulum swinging, because for you, you know what happens when the pendulum swings and it eventually sits. Do you know my question?
Some of the answer to that is time. I am able to stand up here and say this to you now because I've lived through it. I'm not sure I could have stood up here and said the things that I said while I was in it. So one of the things I would say is that sometimes we look back and are able to see it, but not able to see it in the moment that we're in it. So that's the first thing. The second is that struggle is an option. Nobody has to struggle. Pain happens, discomfort happens, but struggle, that's an option. So if you're identifying that you're struggling, you get to look at, okay, am I choosing to struggle? Because that's an option. Nobody has to struggle. There's no struggle in See How. It's surrender. It is not struggle. If you're struggling, there's something going on. That's optional. But I do think that recovery is not always graceful, and that sometimes we fall down, and sometimes we don't do it very pretty. And sometimes it takes a while to kind of figure out how to do it better. The most important thing is to make the effort and to little baby steps. And you're making baby steps. And as long as we're all taking baby steps, it doesn't have to look graceful. We don't have to be perfect. It doesn't, you know, it's like I'm always the person that wants to go to bed and wake up the next morning 100 pounds less. I want to go to bed and wake up graceful, but it doesn't always happen. Sometimes it takes time, and it's a process. We just have to keep trying, and we have to keep making the effort. So I encourage you to keep trying. Okay, you need to sign, Sue.
Yeah, I'm Sandy, and I'm a compulsive eater.
Hi, Sandy.
Among other things. Anyway, before I ask my question, I want to thank you so much. You are amazing. I think I've heard for the first time here exactly why I've been struggling, a solution, everything, all the work that I've been doing until now has all been bandaged. because I take it right back. You know, I think I'm done. It's done. That resentment's gone. That character. And then it creeps back up. The minute I'm not as diligent, it's all back. And I keep thinking, why? What am I? Anyway, so thank you. The miracle is that I actually heard you.
Yes.
That's the miracle, because, you know, I have to say that the whole time I've been at this convention, I've been restless, irritable, and discontent. Oh, yeah, that's a bunch of BS. Oh, you know, I've been very skeptical. And when I heard you today, it hit me. I feel like I'm you, you know. Anyway, my question is, when your sponsor talked about those character defects, well, those character assets that you really think might really be masking a defect, can you elaborate a little more on that? On what you mean by that, or how you uncovered that?
Yeah, well, the way we worked it was, and it is one of the questions in the 6 through 12 question booklet, but it's the way I started was I started to write out what I thought were positive traits. Now, that was not an easy task, because I could do negative traits from here till tomorrow, but the positive was harder. But I would write down these positive traits, and then I would look at them and go, are they really positive, or what's underneath them? One of my big things is looking at motivation, because you could take the exact same behavior and have two different motivations, and one is healthy and one isn't, right? So being funny, having a sense of humor is a great behavior. If the motivation is to be happy and joyous and free and loving and funny and all that, then it's great. If the motivation is to be hurtful and biting and nasty because you're angry and resentful, then it's not good. So what I would encourage you to do is go beyond the behavior itself or the trait and look at what motivates it. How are you doing it? What's driving the behavior? What's driving it? And then you can usually identify whether it's something positive or something negative. And then if it's something negative, you don't always have to change the behavior, because I'm still funny, right? Yes. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Because people are listening to this, so they can't see your heads bopping. I'm going to say, yes. So I can still be funny, but I change the motivation behind it. So it's like looking, and this is what I do with my sponsees all the time, is let's look underneath the behavior. Right. Just looking at the behavior is not enough. It's not enough to just look at why do I eat, that I eat. It's like, why do I eat? What causes me to have to compulsively eat? I know the addiction is the addiction to sugar and flour, but how many times, and I'm sure everybody's had this experience, where I was off sugar and flour for many, many, many times and always went back. Why would that be? And it says it in the book. If our problem was just stopping, you'd stop and you'd be done. Staying stopped is the problem, right? So we have to look at what's underneath that. So I would suggest, if you want to delve into that, is to look underneath those behaviors as to what's motivating them, and that may give you some idea.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. Could you sign the paper up here? Oh, you did already? Okay. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Gabrielle. I'm a compulsive eater.
Hi, Gabrielle.
Thank you, Ruth. You talked about how, you know, when you first went through the steps, you did the steps 6 through 12, and you read them to your sponsor, and then you've had, you know, a quarter of a century of continuing to work step 6 and 7. Would you share with us, I don't know if you went back and did those steps again in the green book, or could you share how you've kind of worked those, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of different ways, actually. To be honest, one of the ways that I've done it is by working with sponsees and working with them on their steps. That is like such a goal mine. I mean, talk about like a goal mine, right? To work with others and work with them to go through their steps, because everybody has different perspective, everybody has different experiences, and you get to learn from that. So that's one way, and I've sponsored people over the years, so I've definitely had a lot of opportunities to hear other people's 6 and 7 steps and talk about them, and so that helps me too, right? One of the other ways is to do a lot of work on my adult child stuff, so to really go back to the origin of a lot of these defects. You know, I didn't just wake up one day and become fearful. I didn't just wake up one day and decide, I have to be by myself. You know, it happened over a period of time. So I will say that one of the things I did was to go back and trace the origin of some of these defects, these more subtler defects. You know, obviously the obvious ones were dealt with fairly easily. It's the subtle ones. It's the ones that don't make your life totally unmanageable, but keep you this far away from happy, joyous, and free, right? Those are the ones that gnaw at you, or, you know, you just want to not think about them or whatever. And those are the ones that I worked on tracing back to the origins of those, which mostly were, for me, in my childhood. And they were developed over a period of time of needing to survive, needing to protect myself, needing to deal with feelings that I had no outlet for. And so I would go back and heal some of those wounds, which then took care of the defects today. You know, one of the things that I discovered is that there's a reason why I do what I do today. You know, there's a real reason. And when I address that reason, I don't have to do it anymore. So that's another way that I did it. And the other is to really just pay attention. One of the things I love is where it's in step 11, it says conscious contact with God. And I spent a lot of time trying to make contact with God. And then one day I realized I'm focusing on the wrong word, because it's not my job to make contact. God is there. I don't need to make contact. I need to be conscious. First step of being conscious, abstinence. Cannot be conscious if I'm stoned, right? But then I have to be paying attention. I have to see what I'm doing every day. I have to see what's going on. I would write positive things that I did every day. I would write things that happened that day. I would start to have a consciousness of what I was doing, and was I happy about it or not happy about it. And then if there was things that I was not happy about, then I would work on them. I would talk to my sponsor about them. I would write about them. I would look at the origins of them. I would pray to have the ability to not do them anymore, and then I would practice not doing them. So that over time, that's what I started to do, rather than like answering a question and writing them all down, but paying attention on a regular basis as I go through my life. Because things are always coming up. They're always coming up. Newer, subtle things, you know, little things. The road narrows, people. The road narrows, and the longer you're here, the less it takes to make me uncomfortable. Right? So what used to take this much to make me uncomfortable now takes this much to make me uncomfortable. But that's great, because I don't change till I'm uncomfortable. So I always say, I'm not going to change till I hit a wall, so my job is to get closer to the wall faster. So I change quicker. Right? So that's what I did. So on an ongoing basis, it's about being conscious, paying attention. What's not working for me? What am I not happy about? What would I like to have different? Well, how would I like to be different? And then identify those things and then do the work on those. Is that helpful?
Yeah.
Thank you. Anyone else? We have time for one or two more. Judith?
So, hi, I'm Judith. I'm a compulsive eater.
Hi, Judith.
So, on the line of being conscious and having daily contact with God, and it's not your statement that it's not my responsibility to initiate the contact, but to be available, is that what you're saying?
No, my job is the consciousness part, okay, not the finding God part, because God is there. So it's like, yeah. I was seeking, I was reading books, and I was trying to figure out what he looks like, and I was trying, you know, all that kind of stuff, so that I'd have, because, you know, I'm an intellectual. So I want to have a picture. Does he have a beard? Is it a girl? What does he look like? Yeah. What is it? Where is he sitting? Is he up there? Is he down here? I need to know. And finally, I'm like, I don't need to know.
Right.
That doesn't matter. What matters is that I stay conscious. I pay attention. One of the things that I would do to try to stay conscious that my higher power is with me all the time is that I would make every day, I'd write 3 God things for that day, things that happened that day that I associate with God. Now, some may be finding a parking space, some, but they become other things, things that I would never think, things that people would say, oh, what a coincidence. There's no coincidence. Well, they say that's God acting anonymously, right? There's no coincidence. But if I'm not conscious and seeing it as a God thing, then I don't get the benefit of realizing that God is everywhere and doing everything. Do you know what I mean? So it's not my job to go out and figure out what he is or who he is or where he is or go find him, or I have to go to church to find him, or I have to go to temple to find him, right? He's here. It's with me. This power is with me. My job is to pay attention, to see it. It's about perspective. You know, I have a disease of perception. So I can see anything negative or positive. I choose to see it as a God thing. Everything. Everything. What I consider to be bad or good is not in God's world. Everything is part of the plan. And when you can see it that way, then you don't have to struggle and you don't have to suffer. Those things are optional. So that's, does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Judith, you need to sign. Thanks, Sonny. Time for one more.
Hi, Avi, compulsive eater.
Hi, Avi.
Thank you so much, Ruth. You know, I just want to pitch gratitude, actually. I feel like I have been sitting in Oprah's audience. I've had so many aha moments, and I feel like you've just given me a car. I really do. I feel like you've just given me a Cadillac. You have just made this conference like this for me.
Oh,
just,
thank you.
I just want to say thank you so much. I was sitting there, and I've had tears rolling down my face because I've just connected so much with what you said. Just
thank you.
So grateful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate that. Thank you. Anybody else? We do have time for another one. Anyone else? Dave? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Dave.
Hi, Dave.
I wasn't going to do this because I was afraid it would make me cry, but something you said when you were talking...
I'm sorry, something you said when you were talking. There was a time when you were sponsoring me, and you told me, you said you would only sponsor me if I did these things, and one of them was 30 meetings in 30 days. And I said, okay. And then you said, at the end of 30, you said I had to do 60 and 60. And I remember saying, you know, that's not fair. I have a life, I have kids, this and that. And you said this isn't a negotiation. And so I did it. And when I got to 90, or when I got to the end of the 60, you said you wanted me to do another 30 and 30. And I said, come on, Ruth, how long do I have to keep doing this? And you said, until you want to. And it didn't make any sense. I mean, why would I want to do a meeting every day? But then I had one of those ahas maybe 3 months later, realizing, why wouldn't I want to? It's keeping me abstinent.
Exactly.
Thanks.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate that. Okay. We are out of time unless we have a burning desire. I mean, I could go all night, so anyone else? Okay, thank you so much for coming, and I appreciate it so much. Thank you.